Hey, I'm Nathan Lee Graham.
Hi, this is Lynn Nottage.
Hey guys, it's Saheem Ali.
Hi, this is Michael Benjamin Washington. You are listening to the Call and Response Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Call and Response Podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. And y'all, whether you like it or not, it is beginning to look a lot like the most wonderful time of the year. Thanksgiving is next week, Starbucks has rolled out their holiday cups, and Netflix has been recommending new holiday rom-coms every chance it gets. And personally, as a Christmas baby, I'm totally down for this. If you're like me and you're ready to embrace all things that are merry and bright, then you have to dive into all of Gold Star's holiday offerings. From the Coco's and Carol's holiday cruise to Love Actually, the unauthorized musical parody, there's so much to enjoy during this holly jolly season. But as y'all know, that's only the beginning with Gold Star. They provide affordable tickets to theater, comedy shows, concerts, and so much more. So download Gold Star and let's make some memories, y'all. Every week I'm like, I'm so hype, I'm so thrilled, I'm so excited, and I am still hype and excited and thrilled every week because there are so many amazing artists out here, and I feel so hashtag blessed to talk to all of them. This week is actually very special too because this guest is from Plano, Texas. He loves chilies, and which is are like the important things to know right off the bat. And you may have seen him in Mamma Mia, La Cage aux Folles, Boys in the Band, and he is currently starring in Fires in the Mirror at Signature Theater. Anna Deavere Smith's groundbreaking piece. I saw it a couple days ago, and y'all, he just like left it all out on the stage, so I'm ready to dive in with him, learn more about his artistic journey, learn more about the show. It's Michael Benjamin Washington.
What's up, Alicia?
Hi. I'm like, you know, you meet people and you immediately click and you're like, I know they're probably freaked out because I'm acting like we're best friends, but they just have something about them that makes you feel that way.
I'm telling you, you could be my play cousin.
Okay,
we just got to figure out the actual blood relation.
I know. It would have to be like a father, like maybe our dads are brothers or something like
that.
Yeah,
like isn't your dad in Plano, Texas?
Yeah.
Well, come on now.
See? So we made it work. Someone write this play. Anna Deavere Smith write this play for us. Yeah, no, I want to hear about how you got involved in performing arts in Plano, Texas. Mm-hmm. You said you did speech and debate.
Yep.
You did UIL.
Yep.
How did you get involved?
Well, I think my first professional job was when I was 11. My mother thought I had a lot of energy and put me into an acting class.
Yes.
And I got an agent at the Campbell Agency in Dallas, Texas. Kaylin Tempton was my agent.
Shout out.
And my first job was a JCPenney commercial with this Dallas cowboy named Harvey Martin from the 70s.
Okay.
And I played his son. And I was like, ooh, this is my first time on a set. And that was like, that was the bug biting, actually.
Yeah.
And then my mother was like is a community activist in Dallas. And
great.
So she put together this huge thing called the Juanita Jewel Craft Awards at the Majestic Theater downtown Dallas.
Yes.
She rented that bad boy out and
wow.
She had all this black talent, like the local black high schools were doing their choirs and fashion designers. And it was all tribute to this community activist named Juanita Craft.
Wow.
And I got this little speech. I guess that's when I was six, actually. And
okay.
There's a video of it, and I might have to find it and post it for you to see.
I would love that. Yes.
That was my first time on a stage. And I'm telling you, when that spotlight hit me, it was like, what is this ocean?
Mm-hmm.
It was like an ocean of approval from the light.
Wow.
And the audience was giggling because I was, you know, small and trying to reach the microphone, and somebody had to come over and get it. But I heard like a wave of laughter and approval, and I think that's when the bug bit me. But then I grew up and did it in high school and speech and debate. In Plano, Texas, doing George C. Wolfe's A Colored Museum. I won a national championship with that. And
wow.
Then got to go to the White House and perform it for President Clinton.
Wow.
Yeah, my senior year as a presidential scholar. So it's been an incredibly blessed journey. I mean, and I say blessed meaning I tried to run from it, but it seemed like it was meant for me.
And so, calling you.
Yeah. Like even these jobs that I've gotten now, Boys in the Band and Fires in the Mirror, I haven't auditioned in a very long time because I auditioned so hardcore for 15 years.
Yeah.
That when I stepped out and started doing my own thing, that's when people started to call.
Wow.
So there's power in letting go, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So when you were doing all of these things in high school even and going to D.C., like, was it a thought of, oh, I am going to do this professionally or just like, this is something, a passion I love to do right now?
I think I wanted to see if the passion I loved right now could lead me to do it professionally. Mm-hmm. Because we're all told you won't probably make it if you choose to be a professional actor just because of the odds.
I see. Oh, sure.
So I didn't know why I would be special. I didn't know why it would work out for me and not work out for, you know, the other talented, particularly black boys that I knew. Mm-hmm. Like, how, where's my lane? What am I going to do? Because I went to college, like, doing UIL one-act play. We did The Misanthrope my junior year. Mm. So I'm doing Molière, and I'm like, well, when I get into the real world, is anybody going to cast me as a French fop named Orant? Mm-hmm. Will I really need to know these rhyming couplets? Mm-hmm. And when you start to do work like Anna Deavere Smith and you learn how to do things in iambic, it really does help tremendously when you get to do our writing. And Terrell Alva McCraney writes in a very specific style.
Yes.
And if you're not used to working in a specific style, then you can't magically just pull it out. You beep. I don't know if I can curse the fuck here.
No, this is a safe space podcast. You can say whatever you need to say.
Yay.
Well, and so, you know, with your speech and debate, I know you had exposure to Anna Deavere Smith, but did you feel like you got to have influences from other black writers at that time?
Yeah. Actually, my mother, Bernice Ajay Washington, who celebrated her 70th birthday yesterday in Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
And still looks 40, which is amazing.
Happy birthday to you.
Right? She was, like I said, a community activist and a microbiologist. Like, she's like an every woman. But when my mother found out that I was bitten by the bug, she got on the board of directors of the Cultural Affairs Commission of Dallas, which means they pass out all the money to all the arts organizations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Got you.
So there were tickets to everything from the Dallas Black Dance Theater to Junior Black Academy of Arts and Letters.
Okay.
To everything. So I remember in the 10th, 9th grade, we went to the Junior Black Academy to see One Monkey Don't Stop No Show by Don Evans, starring Kim Fields and Marla Gibbs. And it was called Chitlin' Circuit. And she's like, I want you to see the Chitlin' Circuit. Then we're going to go to New York. And then I want you to see what, you know, the little community theaters are doing in Dallas. And then I want you to see what Off-Broadway is. Yeah. The first thing she let me do was the head of custodial services at our church was a playwright. Mm. So she's like, you're going to go over to the hood. Wow. And you're going to go and do this play for him. And then if you, you know, do good with that, then I'll introduce you to some of the people that I've met on this board. So she's like, I want you to know how we have to survive as black artists.
Yes, yes.
So when I saw One Monkey Don't Stop No Show, that was the first piece that I did in competitive speech and debate in a very white high school. I mean, Plano Senior High is the whitest that it can get.
Right.
1,492 kids, 30 of us were black, and I was class president for 5 years.
Wow.
So that could tell you the complications that my therapist and I combed through when I got to New York. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like functioning in a white space like that?
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I was bringing in heritage, like plays like One Monkey and the Frederick Douglass Journals is what was my dramatic interpretation in George C. Wolfe's The Colored Museum.
Right.
And my one man, The Wiz. It was always about doing black work and not trying to be something that I wasn't. Then I got to NYU and they're like, okay, now we're going to train you like we do everybody.
Yes.
And then that became, I guess that became the range in my portfolio.
Okay.
So I'm glad I went and had to study what the white boys had to study, because now I actually do get to play some of those parts because people have opened up their minds.
Right. Did you feel like you had to like code switch at all during that, or were
Okay. Oh yeah. But it was almost like code switch has become code for talking white, but sometimes it's also saving heritage for when we're around each other. You know, it wasn't giving away our secrets. It was when I was around the black kids, you know, and I would only take, I mean, I'm fully gay now, but I would only take the most beautiful black girl in school, Lissa Keys, to homecoming.
I see.
Prom, Danielle Anderson. I had, you know, I always made sure the sisters had a date, you know, and that was important to me, you know. So it's been a very, very humbled life in that sense. I mean, my parents met and fell in love at a historically black college and university, Southern University, and you know, both belong to Greek organizations and stuff like that. So
I'm curious, too, because I did not, like, although I have roots in Plano and Texas, I did not grow up there. And I'm always curious because when I went to college in Austin, the racism is like very blunt. Do you know what I mean? Versus maybe somewhere like New York or like me growing up in the Pacific Northwest, it's the white liberalism can be a bit more nuanced and subtle,
absolutely.
Like the racism there. So what did you feel kind of a culture shock when you came to NYU?
No, actually, because my freshman year in my dorm, it was six of us in our suite, and they were all from India. So it was like Previn, what was his name? Previn something. And they were like from Istanbul, India. Like, it was hard to find a white person when I got to NYU, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And then I moved into the musical theater wing, and I'm like, here they are.
They've been hiding here.
That's where they all are. Yeah. They're trying to be Bernadette Peters. And, you know, I'm like, okay.
Betty LaBone, yeah.
Yeah. So on this island, there's a lot of different races, and just depends on what part of town you're in.
That is a really great way of saying that. So what was that first year transition like for you then?
Coming from the South, and my mother's the daughter of a sharecropper, and my father is the son of a sergeant in the Army who came up through an integrated world, and my mother was very much in a, you know, poor Southern way, and they only lived 45 minutes away from each other growing up. I had that reality mixed with suburbia. Then I came to the island of Manhattan, so I felt like I had all parts in me. Which is why it's not that difficult for me to reach for all the different characters like I play in Fire in the Mirror.
Right.
You know, I know almost all of these people.
Yeah.
And I've had dinner with them and have like broken bread with them. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like I saw them on the street or on the subway.
Mm-hmm.
I know the dude with the gold tooth who has been labeled as, did you kill that kid?
Mm-hmm.
I know the Jewish lady who's like, I just want to protect this beautiful house that my husband and I have lived our entire lives and worked our entire lives to protect. I know who all those people are.
Yeah.
So it is kind of like bringing a sympathy to them, but also an understanding. But then, you know, some skepticism about how protected and what privilege really is, what black privilege is, what white privilege is, what all the privileges that we have are.
That's so real, too, because I feel like in this conversation of like in the mainstream of diversity and representation and inclusion, it's still a very like perhaps narrow version of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's. People think of blackness as a monolith, and I think now, and Anna DeVere Smith was doing this with her piece in 1992, but it's fragmenting that idea and busting down the monolith to say there are so many different experiences, even within blackness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should just dive into Fire in the Mirror, because that is a behemoth, like I said the other day, of a show. 28 characters?
Yeah, somewhere between 27 and 29. I actually need to sit down and count so I can actually say the number.
But like 25 plus, okay, y'all. And that is still insane, regardless if it's 28 or 29, to be able to tackle all of those characters. Mm-hmm. So context for the listeners, Anna DeVere Smith, shout out, wrote this piece in direct response, to the riots that were happening in Crown Heights, Brooklyn in August 1991.
Mm-hmm.
A rabbi ran a red light, hit and killed a young 7-year-old named Gavin. This is me just trying to prove to Michael that I was paying attention during the show, really. I'm like, let me just say this to you. And then a young group of black men retaliated in a way by stabbing a young Hasidic Jewish man.
Mm-hmm. From Australia.
Ooh, so yeah. So speaking of Australia, the accents.
There's a lot
of them. Okay, Australia. Like, there are so many that you do.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, like, I was watching a video of you and Saheem Ali, podcast alum. Shout out to Saheem. Like, you were saying, I was so excited to just start tackling all of these characters. And he was like, slow and steady wins the race. Talk to me about the rehearsal process.
Well, it was really, really very, it was an incredible process, because my dialect coach, Dawn Ellen Frazier, who is a professor at NYU, beautiful sister, who has been dialect coach of Tina musical to Once on This Island to, I mean, she does everything.
I love it.
And so we would start our day at noon, and we would work for 2 hours. She would warm up my voice, and then we'd go through each character, and she'd give me either phonetics, we'd watch YouTube clips, we go through exercises and to figure out how each one of these Caribbean men are different, where what part of my voice they live in.
Mm-hmm.
Al Sharpton, you know, studying him because he was 250 pounds at this time. So the weight of his voice sitting in the back of a barrel and trying to get that kind of loudness that can fill a theater.
Yeah.
Versus
those details.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to just be able to do that and learning to condition my throat. That's why I sound real, real used right now. Like I've had about 3 whiskeys and 14 cigarettes, which I wish I had. But
I like it. It's sultry. It's like sultry NPR, you know?
It's got a little amber onto it.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, figuring out that, and then the Australian dude when he's screaming, then the Australian dude when he's sitting on a suitcase, and the different kinds of Lubavitch women, and then the Hasidic women, and knowing that there's a difference, and the young brothers, and who's different, you know. Henry Rice, you know, is very, very excited, you know. He's just like your kid from Brooklyn. But then the bruh who's telling you, you know, I need you to know that that youth didn't kill that Jew. And they come kind of close to each other, and you have to be able to switch quickly but distinctly. And it's been Saheem's brilliant direction in pacing myself, because I like to jump in and go for it. But he's like, okay, good. We've worked enough today. We're just going to work for 2 hours today. Now go home and rest.
Wow.
And go home and learn the lines. It's 84 pages of just me talking.
Yes.
In poem form. So
right.
Every line break that Anna writes gives a certain thought. So it's written like a poem.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like if I learn bruh, or we call him bruh, but he's anonymous man number two. And Saheem is like, you get to pick one item from this huge table of props that you think would help identify who the character is. And I'm like, for this guy, I want a gold tooth. And he's like, okay. So they fit me for a gold tooth. We got a gold tooth. We were in a run through. The gold tooth got stuck. We had to stop rehearsal. I had to go to the gold tooth doctor and get it like chiseled out of my head. It was so funny.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, so like I learned that monologue. So I was like, oh, this is easy. It's just like he says this and go. And Anna's like, you know, every line break matters. So then you had to learn it like that Jew didn't get killed by that youth. And learning that every line break is a different thought. And so I had to go back and relearn the whole piece based on the line breaks.
But and the cadence.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
The rhythm of it.
You can hear the people come alive when I read it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, versus just when I act it for you.
Well, but even when you were just doing it just now, I noticed the gestures that you instinctively went with it, with the voice.
Mm-hmm.
How, I guess I'm just so fascinated by... And I guess I said this on Instagram Live the other day, too, but like that you have like a physical cue for yourself. And it just seems like it's all connected between your physicality and the vocal. That just seems daunting to learn, though.
It could be. It could be. I sat in a Starbucks in New World Plaza and just sat there and I'm like, set my phone timer for 2 hours. And whatever you learn in that 2 hours, just memorize it.
Wow.
And so a lot of 2 hours went by quick, you know, but I had time. It was funny because I had to learn 4 monologues for the original audition that I put myself on tape for.
Okay.
And then they needed to see me in person, of course. So I flew in on my day off from filming Boys in the Band.
In L.A.
Ooh,
the time difference.
Flew to New York. Yeah, it was crazy. And I learned 2 monologues on the plane, got off, did them. And then I got there and Anna's like, can you step outside and learn some of Angela Davis? I just want to see a cold reading. I was like, damn it. So then I learned Angela, which is the hardest monologue in that show, because I'm like, what is she talking about? Because, I mean, like, you have to really get up underneath the text to know what she's talking about. The feminism versus the Clarence Thomas versus the black in the community. And it's like, okay, all right. So she wanted to see how my mind worked on the fly.
A cold read. Ooh, Anna.
Yeah. I was like, come on, training. Right. Don't fail me now.
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of the audition and casting process, I don't know how much you know, but, like, you are the first person other than Anna to do it,
yeah,
which is amazing
and
so exciting for you. But I'm curious, like, in terms of switching gender, like, it doesn't matter because you both have played, I mean, all the characters are different genders, but did you and her talk about that at all?
Oh, yeah. She was very much the advocate for wanting a male to do it, A, so that a woman wouldn't be compared to her.
Oh, right. Sure.
2, she also wanted to see a black male body tell this story because she thought it's as much a black male story because it is about the father of Gavin Cato, which is where the play lands on.
Right.
And it's very much about grief and his grief. So we're leading up to that. So I know she wanted to see what the black male body's experience of doing this play was like for her. And she was so open and so kind and so incredibly generous with me.
Yeah.
And the notes and, you know, I call her Mother Hen and all that kind of stuff. And
it was such a full circle moment, right? From speech and debate to like being in the rehearsal room with her.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, because it was kind of full circle, too, when I did Lacage and Harvey Fierstein was sitting there and so many kids had done Torch Song Trilogy.
Okay.
In speech tournaments.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, I'm seeing the man who's here. And then my buddy, Michael Urie, who was in my class at Plano Senior High School, got, you know, handed that piece by Harvey. And so I watched Michael the past 2 years take on the torch, you know, literally and metaphorically, and seeing like, ooh, what would that be like? What would that be like? What would it be like if Whoopi Goldberg gave her play to, or if Lily Tomlin said, hey, Leslie Kritzer, why don't you do Search for Signs?
Producers.
I've been putting that into the universe for so long.
I love that.
I want to see that. And it's like, when these greats pass it to somebody of the next generation, it's just the honor of honors.
Absolutely.
So I just didn't want to fuck it up. You know what I mean?
I do. That is a lot of pressure in a way. Yeah. You said she was very open and in discussion of the characters with you.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And I mean, and she liked what I was doing, but also was hard on me in the perfect kind of a way.
Yeah.
I mean, her notes are so specific, but but you know, she really gave the space for Saheem and I to make a production. She said in the beginning it was a linguistic study. It was like this thing that she built for herself, but she's always wanted to make sure that this could exist as a play.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to come as an actor, not as a mimic. Not as somebody who can do voice work, but like, this is a scene. Who am I talking to? I'm talking to Anna Deavere Smith. What do I want from her? What do I want to prove to her? Follow the verbs. Here's the text. You got 2 pages or 4 pages.
Yeah.
Or one of the characters she cut was 8 pages. I was like, oh, good. He's gone.
What?
Yeah, Leonard Jeffries. Lord. It was a long one.
Lord. So I have to know some of the audience reactions you've had to this piece, because I myself, like, there are such specific moments that are for both audience. Let me say it a different way.
Say it.
Well, I was going to say both audiences because I just felt like she had very specific moments for all different audience members. And I just feel like because we see so many white people in the theater, these types of works can often be writing for like the white gaze with that in mind. But she, and I'm curious to know if it was you, Saheem, her, all y'all together, the combing of the hair, but not just that, the taking of the hair out. I was like, I feel so seen right now. Like that. I loved those moments of specificity in this.
Yeah. Well, that was an evolution, and okay, so I told you that Saheem's like, here's a table of props. And so like for that one, he's like, here's a purple backpack. And I want you to kind of like hang off the edge of the stage. So like in the rehearsal room, there's this tape on the floor. So I'm kind of like crouched on the floor with this backpack. And I'm like, I feel like I'm in the fetal position and it's cutting off my breath and I'm not sure who she is. So like the second week of rehearsal, I was like, can I get a comb and let me comb her hair? Because the stage direction says she has straightened hair.
Okay.
I'm like, anytime you tell me that a black girl in Brooklyn has straightened hair, that says something about her. And she's talking about race. You need to see her with this hair.
Yes.
So we got the comb, and Saheem was like, I could watch you do this all day long. He was so happy with this.
Good.
And then Anna came in, and she's like, I don't know if a black girl would have that kind of a hair. And then it became this really cool conversation about nowadays, girls got units. They can go blonde hair. They can get the white hair.
Right.
And they can look, you know, just like the other if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. But she's like, I don't know if in 91. And I'm like, okay. So then she's like, could you be braiding your hair? Then she's like, can we get another actor to come out and be braiding your hair? And Saheem's like, it's a one-man show. She's like, does he have an understudy? He's like, no, it's a one-man show.
Lord.
So we kind of settled on the combing, which I love the combing.
Bravo. Great instinct and choice on your part.
Thank
like
you.
It's those moments that are like, it feels so real and authentic.
Yeah. You feel like you know her.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you.
So what have been, sorry, that was a roundabout way. What have been some of the other audience reactions to these types of moments in the show?
They feel like they're learning something, and I'm trying to, it's so funny you say that, because I feel like when there are black people in the audience, there's a very specific chuckle, a chuckle of recognition.
Mm.
And that's what I do those moments for.
Mm-hmm.
When white people see it, it's like they're learning that we too comb our hair.
Mm.
And when the comb gets too bunchy, you have to remove the hair from it so that you can continue. Oh, it's like they're studying. So they're very quiet.
Yes.
And that can be hard because, I mean, these have been predominantly white audiences who, like when Big Mo, the black female L.A. rapper, comes out, they get very, very, wait, what is this play? What's happening? I thought this was about Jews. And they get very, 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 and then towards the end of it, they feel like, oh, I feel invited into it. And then they let go.
Right.
But you do have to work hard or just give over to go on the field trip.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
Anna always says, it's like, how do you meet the stranger, with kindness or hatred. And so some people come with Mo with their arms crossed and eventually uncross them. Some people come to the anonymous girl combing her hair and they chuckle at her cuteness until they realize, oh, that could be my kid who combs her hair and probably has great observations on the different classes within her school.
Yeah, it was. And that was the thing, too, like knowing that it was all like that. It was all truthful. It was not fabricated at all.
Right.
I loved as well. Like, I felt like that added another level to this of just like, wow, like this is. I keep coming back to the word truthful, but like this was the real deal.
Verbatim accounts from people's actual lips. Yeah.
You know, and the other thing I was thinking during it was like, it felt, and I don't want this to have a negative connotation. It felt very academic, and
yeah,
I don't mean that in a bad way, but I was just like, you know what? They're just giving to me straight. They're giving it to me straight. Mm-hmm. Like it's a documentary on stage. Mm-hmm. And there was something really refreshing about that to me.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't need the bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. And so that got me thinking, why don't we do that more in the theater?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a loaded question. I don't know if you can even answer that. But
no, my agent, my writing agent, Michael Finkel, who's been repping me for 7 years, he's like, you need to write a documentary play, because I've been asking him all these questions. And he's like, that's the thing that you want to say then.
Mm.
You need to continue in that vein now that you've done all this work and research.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're talking about a project that we want to put together with it. But yeah, it's very true. And what's interesting is people do watch this show, especially yesterday's matinee, which was a Saturday matinee. They watch it like they're watching a Netflix special.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing about that is, you know, it's so of the moment.
Mm.
It's like we're used to binge watching things in our home, but at the same time, we're also used to binge watching it without reaction. So when I'm up there, I don't get any feedback. I don't get any energy because people are so used to putting a glass blue screen between themselves and the emotion.
Right.
But in the theater, I need
that
energy.
Feedback, yeah.
You know, it's a temple. It's like going to church. Will the choir sing as well as they can if you sit there with your arms folded?
Mm-hmm.
Will the preacher give you everything he has if he hears no amen?
Mm-hmm.
So that has been one of the challenges. But I realize that they're quiet because they are in it, not because that they're, you know, out of it.
But I think that you touch on something really important too, in terms of like having different audience members, because there were several moments I felt like laughing or you know, things like that. And already having seen that it was a mostly white audience, sometimes it doesn't feel, I don't know if safe's the right word, but it feels like uncomfortable because of the amount of stories I've heard of like white people shushing audience members, you know? So it is an interesting space to create in that way.
I mean, I often think of the theater as a temple, and so it depends on how you worship. Black people are very vocal when they worship.
Yeah.
White people are very quiet when they worship.
Yeah.
So depending on what you're getting from, you know,
your experience.
Yeah.
It's true. That's true. That's a good point. Another moment I loved was the top of the show. And, well, first of all, I love the mirrors and, like, making us audience members complicit. I was, like, noted. I'm like, I see all of this. But was the first piece, the first monologue of Ntozake Shange.
Boom. Okay. You said it.
About identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved her definition of it. I was like, wow. Like, it was just, it felt very familiar, but also like made me think of different things in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious what, if you had been thinking about your own personal definition of identity since this.
Huh. That's a good question. Because Anna divides the play up into seven chapters, there's identity, hair, mirrors, rhythm, race, and then the Crown Heights section is like one whole act.
Mm.
That was six. There's one more that I'm missing in there. Hair. Each one of those chapters kind of begins whichever monologues are underneath that umbrella.
Right.
And they connect like a theme.
Mm-hmm.
So identity is the first one that we see. And then George C. Wolfe and anonymous Lubavitch woman are all within that blanket. So you kind of go from her definition into Zaki's, into this Lubavitch woman, into George C. Wolfe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my collective definition of identity has become disparate ends of our identities as a collective community, this black woman, a gay black man, and a Hasidic woman, all have a very, very similar definition of what identity is and how they have been, in a way, misinterpreted through time. I think what Intozaki says is so powerful about we become part of whatever we are a part of at that moment, but that does not become our identity. Mm-hmm. We take with it what we learn from it, but we don't become that thing.
Right.
George says something very, very similar about when I am a part of the Black community, I am very much revered. The second I go beyond a certain point, I am insignificant. Mm-hmm. The Lubavitch woman says, within my home and my structure, and you see her folding laundry of probably her 18 children mm-hmm. in a house robe. She's like, I needed somebody to help fix this problem. I had to leave the safety of my compound and find a little Black boy who would come into my house, fix it, and we shared a laugh.
Yeah.
So it's like how we do have to leave, as Angela Davis also says, leave our comfort zones, leave our communities, and to swing into other communities to figure out how to understand and how to learn.
Right.
And then the play gets more complicated on those themes towards the end when one rabbi is like, I don't believe that we're going to heal this problem by coming together and integrating our two things. Mm-hmm. Just like a Black man, Sonny Carson, is like, listen, I'm not advocating any healing of America and coming together. Then people give the antithesis of that. So the whole play becomes, this study on identity mm-hmm. from these desperate ends of our collective community.
It is so fascinating. It's so great. I could see it like 3 more times and feel like I learned something new every.
Well, I get to do it 8 more times next week, y'all. My throat. Pray for my throat.
I am. I know. And you're killing it up there. You're so present. You're so in it. You leave everything on that stage for real. And you also just finished filming Boys in the Band.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, but also. Y'all did it on Broadway not too long ago either. Like, yeah. You have been going.
Yeah.
What was that experience like of revisiting the work for film?
For film, it was incredible because anytime you do a film, you're doing it for the director. And I think anytime you're doing a play, you're really doing it for the playwright. So when we did Boys in the Band on Broadway, it was because Mark Crowley had not had that story told on the main stem and it gave birth to so many playwrights. I don't think there would have ever been a Torch Song Trilogy or Harvey Fierstein had there not been a Boys in the Band. Wow. I don't think there would have been an Angels in America.
Yeah.
Especially if you read Tony Kushner's foreword to Boys in the Band and you realize how much he has influenced not only queer theater, but just American theater, which is dominated by queer men.
Mm-hmm.
It's been so incredible to have seen him at 85 years old make his Broadway debut.
Yeah.
You know, and on opening night, he came on stage and I like grabbed his hand to help him on stage and walked him to the center to take a bow. And he was shaking like a leaf. And I'm like, sometimes it takes getting to 85 years old before you get that, which is really humbling for me as a playwright. To be like, don't rush it. It'll happen when it's supposed to happen.
Absolutely.
But then when we did the play version, it was all about Joe Mantello making his second feature film, you know, the first being Love, Valor, Compassion, which was many years ago. And being there for Joe and making sure he got everything he needed in the can every single day because it was the same script, same guys, same. We had our energy. We had a wonderful rapport. Mm-hmm. Our camaraderie is unbelievable, which is very, very, very lucky.
Yes, a good squad.
Yeah. And we like taking on, you know, difficult stuff.
Right.
So we had a good time. It was an easy film schedule. It was very laid back. Mm-hmm. Ryan Murphy wanted to make sure that nobody was taxed. Otherwise, you know, there's a way to schedule things so that people enjoy the process. There's a way to do it so that you feel crazy.
Right.
And it was like first class accommodation by Netflix. Holla. Thank you,
Netflix. Shout out to Netflix.
They hooked a brother up.
So then as you're approaching your own work as a playwright and, you know, receiving scripts and choosing work to do, I mean, I just think the as we continue just in general as a theater community, you know, we're starting to explore more and more new voices. Because I do feel like, you know, when we do see queer stories, they still tend to revolve around white men.
Mm-hmm.
So how have you been addressing that in your own work and the scripts you get?
The stuff that I'm writing or the stuff? Mm-hmm. Well, the stuff that I write, like I wrote a play about Bayard Rustin, the openly gay Black architect of the civil rights movement, who was Dr. King's mentor.
Yes.
Who planned, in the play, Blueprints of Freedom, an ode to Bayard Rustin, concerns the 1963 March on Washington and the 2 months he had to plan it to restore his image, having been ousted by the black community and the black civil rights movement.
See, that's the story I want to see.
Right?
Yes.
Right. And so him having to make amends with his protege, Martin Luther King, and getting him on board to do the 11 o'clock number of I Have a Dream. Also, with his female assistant, I really wanted to give credit to all of those sisters who came through those offices with all those ideas and organizational brilliance, who really did make the civil rights movement. So there's a composite character of his female assistant named Miriam Caldwell, who in La Jolla Playhouse was played by Mandy Mast, an incredible actress who was at the matinee today and I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
So I try to make sure that I'm representing not only the male voice, the queer voice, the female voice, the elderly voice. I feel like the elderly, I think once you're over 40 or 50, it's hard to find great roles unless August Wilson wrote you something.
Listen.
You know, and I just want to make sure that there's something. So there's the A. Philip Randolph, the great mentor that nobody really knows about in there.
I love it.
I have a play about the creation of Cry, Alvin Ailey making Cry for Judith Jamison, a very unconventional ballerina, 6 foot dark skinned woman who was told she would never be a classical ballerina. I think that story should be told.
Absolutely. I'm going to become a producer.
Yeah, please.
I can do all of these.
Yeah. So it was great to step out from acting for a while and start writing. I was actually writing Maya Angelou's story for her estate. Jimmy Baldwin is her leading man in that. And then that's when I got the call from Boys in the Band to come back. And then it's been a year and a half, so I got to get back to that and finish it.
Yes.
They're like, can we read that play? I'm like, give me a week.
Right.
These 84 pages memorized, and then
I'll
holla at y'all.
And it is a different like muscle to flex. So I feel like when you're focused on acting, you know, switching back and forth. But
yeah.
I'm ready for these stories to be on stage.
I am too.
I like a
nice queer male black lead and a good strong female lead.
Yes.
So Alvin Ailey, Judith Jamison, Bayard Rustin, his assistant, Maya Angelou, and Jimmy Baldwin. That sounds like fun.
I could talk to you forever, but I know you need to rest the voce, get your steamer. So the final two lightning round questions to wrap it up. If you could recommend a piece of black art for our listeners to take in, whether it's a dance piece, a book, a musical, a film, what would it be?
I really love, I mean, everything of Jimmy Baldwin's I think should be mandatory reading. I mean, that's a really hard one.
Because I
kind of wanted to say, I think everybody should see Revelations, Alvin Ailey's Revelations, which you can find online. I think Jimmy Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, Notes to a Native Son is brilliant.
Those are great ones.
Let's start there.
Y'all start there. We'll keep the recommendations coming as we go. And then the second one is not any easier. If you could give a shout out to a fellow black artist, who would it be? And if you want to do like a top three or a top five, because it's just about elevating and giving love.
Yeah. You know what? I would have never written my play Blueprints of Freedom, an ode to Bayard Rustin, had I not done on my 30th birthday the first reading of Terrell Alvin McCraney's Choir Boy at MTC.
Yes.
I'd auditioned for Brother Size trilogy and I didn't get it. And he's like, there's something in my drawer. And he whipped it out and we read it and I finished it. And the director at the time said, you know, you're a little old to play 16, but Bayard Rustin. I was like, who's that? And seeing what Terrell was doing and then going through that whole thing and seeing where he is now. So on Tony night this year, which was my 40th birthday. Yeah. We won for Boys in the Band. And in the wing, I saw Terrell Alvin McCraney about to come on to introduce a choir boy segment that was about to perform. And that moment for me was like exactly 10 years it took him to get that play to Broadway. Mm-hmm. Exactly 10 years it took me to get back to Broadway. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, it was. So I give a lot of shout out and a lot of love to Terrell.
Shout out indeed. That's cosmic.
Yeah,
that gave me chills.
Yeah,
that's beautiful. I'm glad you got to share that moment. Y'all, give it up for Michael. He's the best. You can come see him in Fires in the Mirror at Signature Theater through December 15th.
Possibly longer. We're still talking about it.
Ooh, okay, y'all, for real, get your tickets. Well, because y'all are sold out,
yeah.
So y'all should pray for an extension so you can come see it. If folks want to follow your journey on social media, where can they find you?
Michael B. Washington on Instagram is the best place.
We love it. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Felicia.
And we'll see you next time.